dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. The domestic front in the war is one that is often overlooked, but one cannot overstate the significance of the hand-to-hand combat that's taking place increasingly now here inside America, and notably on Capitol Hill. We've been treated, I guess is the word for it, inflicted with the spectacle of an impeachment of the President of the United States by the partisans in the Democratic caucus, almost all of whom voted to impeach him yesterday, and did so on the basis of what I consider to be scandalously flimsy pretexts. A man who has spent an awfully long time in Washington in a variety of capacities, at the Defense Department, in the United States Air Force, in the Justice Department, and on Capitol Hill as the last nonpartisan general counsel for the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, including during the period in which Bill Clinton, the last president to be impeached, was subjected to a trial and ultimately acquitted. His name is Dan Gallington. He rose through the ranks to be a colonel in the United States Air Force, served in diplomatic missions for the Secretary of Defense, served as a deputy assistant secretary. He served in the Justice Department in a variety of capacities, and a man I've come to respect greatly over the years and always delight in having a chance to visit with, especially to talk a bit about what just went down from the perspective of a longtime insider on Capitol Hill. Dan, it's good to have you back. Welcome, sir.
Thanks, Frank. It's always a pleasure for me to be with you and, you know, reflect on the many, many years you and I have been colleagues and friends. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you. It's been a long time. Dan, so give us just a quick and dirty. Again, you worked on the Senate side. You worked in the Intelligence Committee. You doubtless have some insights into what on earth happened in the House Intelligence Committee over the past few weeks that led up to this impeachment. Give us your sense of it.
Let's look at the two impeachable actions that the House came up with first, and then we'll go take a look at what Hepsi did. I think it's amazing, and I don't know why people are not making this point over and over again. The bottom line is that our president is being impeached for being our president. And it really gets down to that. If you look at the two grounds for impeachment, one, abuse of power, and you look at that a little more closely, you realize that this whole dispute arose out of the administration of security assistance, which by law, the Arms Export Control Act of 1976, is an instrument of foreign policy, and our chief foreign policy officer is the president. Now, sure, it's administered by the State Department, and the Defense Department does the logistics of it, but the foreign policy aspects of security assistance are the most important. And right underneath that is the concern we have traditionally expressed with regard to corruption in the recipient nation. Now, Frank, as you know, security assistance is basically three kinds. You know, it's arms sales, we sell stuff. It's training, what's called IMET, International Military Education and Training, and grant aid, where we just give them money. And then the case that we're involved with now is giving money to the Ukraine. Well, it's absolutely critical that we satisfy ourselves that there is no endemic corruption in the recipient nation.
And in the case of Ukraine, there was an awful lot of that going on for an awfully long time.
Exactly. Look back at the testimony, for example, by one of the State Department officials saying that he raised concerns about corruption during the Obama administration and was told to, you know, be quiet because it affected the vice president's son, and he was in the process of losing another son, and so don't bring it up. But so the idea that there was not a corruption issue that was tied to grant aid money distribution to Ukraine is absolutely crazy. Of course, and the president did exactly what he should have done.
It was his responsibility to do it, I think, is your point. Being the president has that, among many other duties, as one of its hallmarks. And Dan, let me just ask you, and I know you want to say something about the second charge, about obstructing Congress, but before you do, just, you're a career national security professional. And I just wondered, did you find as preposterous as I did, the assertion that was made like a mantra recited endlessly by people who, well, at least in my experience, have not given much of a fig, to be honest with you, about national security, that the president, by withholding this aid temporarily to Ukraine, this security assistance, until he could satisfy himself about the corruption issue, violated or breached or otherwise compromised our national security. What did you make of that?
I have the same reaction. Listening to what I would describe as a deep state witness after deep state witness testifying in the HPSI, I was amazed. And you sort of ask yourself the question, look, whose side are you on here? Your job, State Department, is to facilitate the security assistance which the president has come up with and come to Congress and gotten approval to do. That's money appropriated by the Congress, but it is the president's responsibility to implement the security assistance, and that's exactly what he got impeached for, because he was concerned about the corruption in the recipient nation. Of course, he should have been concerned about recipient.
Hey, Dan, you know, I just have to say that in answer to your rhetorical question, whose side are they on? It calls to mind old Jesse Helms' famous statement that the problem with the State Department is there's no American desk at the State Department. Now, these guys are always inclined to try to find ways to endear themselves to and up the interests of the nations to which, you know, they are assigned or they're with whom they're working at headquarters, perhaps. It's clientitis, and you've seen it up close and personally over the years, including in your stints in Geneva representing us on the arms control talks. Dan, we have to take a quick break, but I did just want to say to listeners that are interested in the truth, the facts about this corruption problem, and the imperative need to get to the bottom of it, I really commend to everybody the 3 one-hour-long segments that were done at One America News Network on this subject. Dan, we're going to come right back, and we're going to talk about some of the other things that you've been tracking closely over the years, including the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act Court and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Our guest is Colonel Daniel Gallington, a career national security professional with distinguished service in uniform, in the civilian ranks of the Defense Department, the Justice Department, and as a general counsel for the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. And Dan, drawing on all of those experiences, you have been warning for quite some time, especially as the anti-Trump conspiracy began to become known, and specifically the efforts that were made to mislead this Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court, the FISA court, about the justification for surveilling an American citizen in the Trump campaign. Give us a readout on both your own thinking on the subject and also the recent findings of the Inspector General of the Department of Justice about those, well, it seems to me, criminal activities.
Yes, Frank, the Inspector General's report is quite insightful. And the recent order by the FISA judge to the FBI to answer certain key questions is derived from that. And as you know, over a year and a half ago, I wrote an op-ed for the Washington Times saying that the FISA judges needed to examine their own procedures for avoiding political bias. And I listed there a dozen questions that the FISA judge should be asking on their own motion. Well, that should have been done a year and a half ago. And it looks kind of sort of guilty knowledge that the FISA court is just now taking what the DOJIG recommended and directing the FBI to answer those questions. I was also remarked about the direction of the FISA court judge. They should be asking DOJ, the National Security Division, those same kind of questions. And even more basic is how were the targeting decisions made for the FISA orders that were granted during this period of time.
Okay, and to just define that term for us, if you would, Dan, targeting of, in this case, Carter Page, I guess.
Exactly, and he was clearly an agent of a foreign power, but that's not necessarily an evil situation. There are lots of agents of foreign powers at work in the city of Washington, D.C., in one representative capacity or another. Well, how did they choose Carter Page as opposed to somebody like Hunter Biden? Now, he certainly was an agent of a foreign power on the board of Burisma with no practical experience in that and with a criminal essentially a criminal administrative record getting kicked out of the Navy. How in the world did they make these targeting decisions? Well, I think the answer is they realized early on in the campaign that the Trump Organization was largely staffed by what you and I would call rookies. These are people who really didn't understand how the intelligence community works and how Washington works. You heard testimony even that when they should have gone over to brief President Trump on a defensive briefing about holes in his campaign and risks he faces, they didn't. They sent an agent over, and they treated it as if he was some kind of suspect in an ongoing criminal or intelligence investigation.
Well, indeed he was.
Yeah, that shows to me that they really didn't think he was serious, and they didn't think they'd ever be held responsible for that.
An even more egregious example of that, of course, was Jim Comey saying after the election that he was going to run an operation against Michael Flynn because they were basically rookies. They weren't organized. It wasn't, you know, a sophisticated administration like the ones that he'd served under previously. This speaks to the character of the people who are doing it, I think, clearly. And I did want to ask you, Dan, as you've worked at senior levels in the Department of Justice and elsewhere, what did you make of Jim Comey's response to the IG's report, that finding 17 very serious problems with how the FBI conducted itself?
I thought it was humorous, actually. I mean, he just sort of shrugged his shoulders and said, you know, well, we screwed up.
Not so much we screwed up, they screwed up. Somebody else screwed up.
Exactly. And where were the executive targeting decisions made? Were the seniors involved in that decision at DOJ or only at the FBI? How do you choose and how do you ignore? How do you ignore a target like Hunter Biden, for example, and choose one like Carter Page? What are those targeting decisions? And I think until we find that out, we're not really going to get the full political twist on these.
Well, I think we've found out all that we're going to find out about it, honestly, and that is that it was obviously a partisan deal, notwithstanding the IG being unable to define it as such. Dan, you mentioned the court, and I just want to come back to that because you were warning about it, as you say, a year and a half ago. What did you make of the letter that the chief judge of the court, the FISA court, that is, put out after the IG revelations? Did that begin to speak to the kinds of self-retrospective analysis that you'd called for? Or is this just, again, a case of sort of deflecting to others? Well, not just blame, but also the responsibility to improve the process.
Yeah, I was have a couple of different feelings about. I read the court's order quite carefully. Number one, what troubles me about it the most is that it's directed only at the FBI, and I think that the targeting decisions that were implemented by the fact gathering or non-fact gathering done by the FBI, that's the critical part. And maybe the court will understand when they start getting feedback. They've asked to have a short time requirement. When they start getting into this, they'll realize how important it is for them to ask very, very basic questions. And getting back to Carter Page and the targeting, the FISA statute basically says agent of a foreign power. It doesn't say a bad agent of a foreign power, or an evil agent of a foreign power, or it just says an agent of a foreign power. So how do you discriminate between all the agents of foreign powers we have in this town, some registered under the Foreign Agents Act and some not? How do you make those? Mostly not.
Yeah. But Dan, in this case, let me just ask you, I don't know which foreign power he was representing, but it has been now established that he was reporting back to the U.S. government all of his contacts with these foreign nationals and was effectively a source for our government in monitoring their activities. This seems like you'd have to go to considerable lengths to justify conducting an investigation against such an individual.
Exactly. Oh, I agree with you 100%. And when you juxtapose a man like a person like Carter Page or General Flynn, juxtapose them to somebody like Hunter Biden, who the State Department had real questions about during the Obama administration and in the administration of foreign aid to the Ukraine. Yet nothing was done there. Nothing. Absolutely nothing.
No. Well, I think actually it's an act of commission. They chose not to pursue or otherwise, hold him accountable. Let me ask you quickly before we run out of time, Dan Gallington, about one other aspect of this. Again, you've given a lot of thought to it over the years. You've been involved in the oversight business. You've been involved in some of the agencies that interface with the FISA court. There's a requirement to reauthorize this court. What sorts of reforms are in order? Or are you of the view, as some of our friends are, that, we just got to get rid of the thing lock, stock, and barrel? My own feeling is we need something like it. What is yours?
I tend to agree with you. When Attorney General Barr also said the other day that he believes that the establishment of the FISA court and the way it's set up is an essential part of our national security structure. And I agree with that. What's lacking here, the demonstration of what's lacking, is the oversight necessary for that to work effectively and not to be an instrument of some kind of political decision. Or my article I wrote a year and a half ago was the politicization of the intelligence process. And we simply have to make sure that the FISA court is not inadvertently or without knowledge brought into something like that by targeting decisions made for political reasons. So I think the oversight mechanism for FISA needs a shakedown.
Now, I've had guests who've said to me that the FISA court actually was on notice that there were problems with what was being done here. I can remember what Joe DeGeneva, I think, was one of those who made this point to me the other day. The suggestion is that they are actually complicit in this failure, not beyond reproach and able to fob the whole thing off on you know, the FBI or DOJ or some other entity.
That would not be my judgment. I've worked with them since the early 90s, and you know, I was deputy in the predecessor office to the National Security Division. I was deputy counsel for intelligence policy in DOJ. Worked with the FISA court and the people there. I can't imagine them being complicit. I can imagine them being in the dark and being kept in the dark.
And that's obviously a fatal flaw with the system. Dan Gallington, this is a subject to which we will return in the new year. I look forward to doing so with you early and often. Thank you for the contributions you've made to our program over 2019 and obviously the continuing service you're rendering to our country. It's deeply appreciated. I look forward to talking to you soon, my friend. Next up, we'll speak with Rochelle Peterson. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by a woman I've come to admire tremendously. She has accomplished something that is not unique exactly, but relatively rare in the world of think tankery. She has injected into the policy world an important insight and recommendation, and it has been taken to heart, I believe, by, well, the United States government and now an increasing number of academic institutions around the country. And indeed, elsewhere around the world. Her name is Rochelle Peterson. She is the director of research projects at the very highly acclaimed National Association of Scholars. And she was the driving force behind a report several years ago now, as I recall, entitled Outsourced to China, the Confucius Institutes and Soft Power in American Higher Education. That study was the shot heard round the world, I guess one might say, these days, or at least the policy equivalent thereof. And Rochelle, I just wanted to have you back on, first of all, to thank you for that important analysis and recommendations that we stop allowing these Confucius Institutes to operate in the United States as an instrument of, well, soft power and political influence operations and the like. So congratulations on it having been heard, and let's talk a little bit about it. First of all, a proper welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank. It's good to join you.
And remind us about basically the key findings of your report.
Right. So these Confucius Institutes are Chinese government-sponsored centers on college campuses where the Chinese government is providing the funding, they're choosing the teachers and the textbooks, and pretty tightly controlling what gets taught there. And as you can imagine, it's a pretty one-sided, censored view of China. And also, these Confucius Institutes form a string of strategic outposts for the Chinese government to monitor and conduct surveillance. So at the National Association of Scholars, we did case studies on 12 Confucius Institutes and put this evidence together and recommended that colleges and universities start closing their Confucius Institutes because this is an inappropriate intrusion by an authoritarian foreign government. And also that the U.S. federal government should respond as well to protect the country from the national security threat that these Confucius Institutes may pose, as well as to protect students from the propaganda and the censorship that the Confucius Institutes bring.
Yeah. And you mentioned that what is at stake is what's taught at these academic institutions, but it's really more than that, isn't it? It's who does the teaching. It's what kinds of things are actually permitted to be said on campuses, even who is invited as guest lecturers on college campuses. I mean, this influence extends quite far beyond just the curricula, bad as that is. And talk a little bit about the funding mechanism that is used to sort of give China this sort of leverage on our own campuses.
Yes, Confucius institutes are an important conduit of financial benefits coming from China. And once colleges and universities tap into that pipeline, they become very hesitant to do anything that would jeopardize it. So the Confucius Institute itself brings in a line of funding. The teachers are directly paid from China, free textbooks. These are basically class-in-a-box kits, everything you need to set up classes on China, and the Chinese government will give it to you for free. So there's that. But then, in addition, once you have a Confucius Institute, the university becomes a priority target for additional funding from China for other grants, for study abroad programs, for trips to China, for the college president to go on a speaking tour, for Chinese government officials to come to campus and give speeches and have other high-profile events. Once you have a Confucius Institute, it opens up a lot of opportunities, and that gives China a lot of leverage over colleges and universities that then become hesitant to upset the Chinese government by inviting a speaker that they wouldn't like or speaking about Taiwan and Tibet in a free and open manner.
Mm-hmm. To say nothing of having textbooks that they don't approve of or aspects of a curriculum. One other element of this, and I don't know whether it's directly tied to the Confucius Institutes, but it's certainly been an instrument for China to exercise influence on academic institutions across the country as well, is it not? That they're also putting large numbers of students into these schools, paying full freight in terms of tuition, which is not something that the schools are able to get away with increasingly with American students. How much of a factor is that in the kind of influence that China is exercising in these other areas as well, Rochelle?
It's a big source of influence. China is the number one source of foreign students in the United States. More than 300,000 students every year come from China to study at American colleges and universities, many of which have become dependent on these foreign students because, as you mentioned, they do pay full tuition. They're not eligible for in-state tuition. Often there's a separate higher rate that's charged just to international students. So they really are a cash cow. And China has been able to leverage that. China controls the flow of students. They control who can go where. And a university that finds itself on the wrong side of the Chinese government could very easily see that line of students drying up.
Yeah. All of which does have an impact in the headquarters or administrations, I should say, of these schools. And yet, Rochelle, the thing that I wanted just to salute you for, among others, is that a number of these schools have, since the publication of your report, begun disengaging from the Confucius Institute treadmill, if I can use that expression. Tell us a little bit about what's happening in this regard and to what extent you think that part it was at least a function of your admonitions.
Well, I think it's a function of many things that in addition to me raising these concerns, the Senate, the U.S. Senate started taking them up and holding hearings, and the Government Accountability Office did its own report on Confucius Institute. So many others started chiming in and raising the alarm. But certainly a number of universities have heard that. So 29 colleges and universities in the U.S. have now closed their Confucius Institutes or are in the process of doing so. The most recent, just announced on Tuesday, is the University of Kansas, which is going to close down its Confucius Institute. And of those 29, 15 of those came in 2019. So this really is a growing wave that leaves 88 Confucius Institutes still operating in the U.S. So there's still quite a ways to go. We are recommending that all of them close, but this is certainly a lot of progress in the right direction.
And what are the schools that are resisting taking this step saying about their relationship with Communist China?
They are pretty much asserting that whatever the risks, they can handle them, that they can stand up to an authoritarian government, that censorship is not going on their campus, that they can guarantee academic freedom. I think that's a lot of bluster, that once they're really pressed, they would be really hard-pressed to avoid some of the pressure that China leverages. But these institutions are asserting that they are up to the challenge.
And I remember one of the things that you were able to achieve in putting the research together for this report outsourced to China, which is available at, is it NAS.org?
Yes, NAS.org.
You were able to document the kinds of commitments that the schools make as part of the deal to allow a Confucius Institute to operate on their campus that really give China the whip hand on these kinds of, you know, curricula, professors, speech even on campus. No?
Yes. Whatever window dressing the universities may want to put on it about academic freedom, at the end of the day, China is providing the funding. China is choosing the teachers, which gives it immense control over what gets taught. They're sending over the curriculum, and they're giving themselves final veto approval on any speakers or events that the Confucius Institute wants to hold. China really does maintain pretty tight control over these Confucius Institutes. And again, because of all the financial benefits that come with this, colleges and universities start finding themselves adopting those guidelines in other areas of the university outside of the Confucius Institute, just to keep that relationship going.
Which is, again, incredibly insidious when you understand what China is trying to do in terms of influencing the perceptions of its conduct or otherwise affecting U.S. policy towards that country in sort of the student body, I guess, in the first instance, most immediately and over time, as those students migrate on to other things, but also in their communities as well. And just lastly, I know there was talk about not allowing schools that have Confucius Institutes to do U.S. government-funded research. Am I misremembering that was bruited about, or has it been adopted? Where do we stand on that idea?
You're right. So the Department of Defense is now banned from giving Chinese language grants, teaching grants to colleges and universities that also have a Confucius Institute. And that has led to quite a few of these universities deciding to close their Confucius Institutes.
And that would be because the language training would be done under the auspices of the Confucius Institute in most of these places. Highly, highly ill-advised for the Defense Department, needless to say. Rachelle Peterson, again, thank you so much both for your time today and for this really important contribution to the effort to counter what China is up to inside our own country. It's hard to overstate the importance of it, and I'm so proud of you for the contribution you've made to some of the progress, and I hope that we'll continue and accelerate in 2020. We'll look forward to talking with you in the new year. In the meantime, Merry Christmas. Thank you for joining us here today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. It's a delight to say, joined by one of my favorite people, Daniel Horowitz. Wickedly smart guy who writes brilliantly at Conservative Review, where he is a senior editor. He is also the star of a Conservative Review television podcast there, and the author of Stolen Sovereignty, How to Stop Unelected Judges from Transforming America. Daniel, it's so good to have you back. Welcome.
Absolutely. It's been way too long.
It has indeed. Let me ask you, Dave, to talk a little bit about the omnibus bill. My recollection is the president had said at one point that he wasn't going to sign any more of those. And this one, like all of them, materialized, it seems, out of thin air to the tune of some 3,000 pages with minutes for people to review and consider and then vote on it. This is no way to run a railroad, I think it's fair to say. But what did you make of what was done by the House of Representatives and what's coming up next on the Hill and with the president?
You know, Frank, we live in surreal times when you're watching the Democrats in the House impeach a president And then the very next day, the response of Senate Republicans and President Trump is to pass and sign and codify a year's worth of their budgetary and policy priorities, because that's what this is. Remember, all but seven Democrats, so you know, out of about 230, voted for this massive omnibus bill. Now, what they do is they don't legislate for an entire year, and then they wait until the end of the year, and they stuff everything in there, and nobody knows what they're voting on. They did this on two bills. They did this on the omnibus bill as well as the defense authorization bill, which is a 3,400-page conference report, and they stuck a bunch of amnesty immigration provisions, criminal justice reform provisions in there, stuff that no one knew was in there. And again, at its core, this is what the president campaigned to stop, that he would be a different type of president, wouldn't do business as usual, would have a transparent debate. There is no reason why the president can't say, look, I was elected to stop this. This is nonsense. Nobody even knows what's in this. Let's pass another clean CR for 4 to 6 weeks so we could discover and debate the provisions in this bill. And all the while, the president needs to start building the case using the bully pulpit backed by the threat of the veto pen to defund sanctuary cities, to get better funding for ICE, and at least some modicum of, I wouldn't even say spending restraint, but I mean, a slightly less of a steep increase. Let me just give your listeners a sense of where we are. The first 2 months of Obama's first fiscal year in FY 2010, that was, I mean, it shocked the consciousness of a nation how much spending we had, right? $471 billion we spent in those first 2 months. First 2 months of this fiscal year, it was $814 billion, almost double. So even if you factor in inflation, this is way overboard. And that was back then with a 10% unemployment rate, revenue in the toilet, the economy was doing bad, people were on programs. Now the economy is humming, unemployment is near record low, 3.5%. That is a pretty damning indictment of Republicans. And it's not just this bill. They've been doing this every single budget bill, even when Republicans did control the House. So let's not forget that at some point, results and outcomes need to matter. We can't be distracted with a soap opera. And certainly, if you're going to focus on the soap opera, the way to retaliate against the Democrats is to not sign their priorities.
So, Daniel, you've been in Washington a relatively long time. You've certainly watched what happens there. This is, I suppose, an example of the old sausage making. You don't really want to see what goes into it. But tell me why the president is going along with this, as best you can tell.
It's very simple. The president doesn't know anything I'm saying. He doesn't know that a provision was stuck in there that basically gives amnesty to anyone who is a sponsor, aka a trafficker of other illegal aliens. He is told that this is an amazing deal and he gets wall funding. And this has been going on for 3 years. Here's the bottom line. The president is not Bill Buckley or Phyllis Schlafly. I mean, he's not. What he is someone with some good instincts who I think intuitively agrees with us, agrees with conservatives on most issues, and he's willing to try new things. But only if you build a movement around him and get the right personnel in and push these policies. But if everyone who has the power to do that on Fox News and talk radio always talks about the soap opera and doesn't focus on the opportunities legislatively, executively, what the president could do, he's not going to do it on his own. And all the pressure is going to come the other direction. Obviously, you got the Kushners in there in the White House. You got many other individuals that are in that cabinet that are not exactly on board with MAGA. So it's not a wonder to me why we're getting this result. It's a wonder to me why some of our colleagues haven't taken advantage of a president who's willing to listen to us and get in his face and his ear a little bit more the last 3 years.
Yeah, not so much take advantage, but reinforce his best instincts and show him a way ahead that would be far more responsible. It sounds like an eminently sensible approach. I gather that the administration is already locked and loaded to go ahead with this deal, though, at this point. Is that right?
They negotiated. I mean, they want it in there. I mean, I'm being told that, for example, on the defense bill, think about this, national defense. You would think it's all about homeland security, right? I mean, that's the cornerstone of national defense. But they offer amnesty to at least 4,000 Liberian illegal aliens. How in the world does that get in there when none of our provisions got in there? Remember, this is right after Pensacola, and there's nothing about arming our soldiers on bases. There's nothing about dealing with visas of dubious foreign military training of nations that are really saturated with radical Islamists.
Yeah, improved vetting, right?
In fact, if anything, it adds another 4,000 SIVs. These are, you know, people that helped our military in Afghanistan, Afghanis, who we've had a tremendous security problem with when we brought them on our shores. But I've heard the White House knew about the Liberian provision. And the Pentagon, which is invade the world, invite the world, that's their modus operandi, they forever want to get involved in these conflicts and then bring in immigrants from both sides of the Civil War, which is the exact opposite of the impetus for 9/11 and its response. We have a broken Pentagon. We have a broken military leadership. The president rightfully said in 2016 that this crop of generals have been reduced to rubble. But these are the very generals that are pushing for more visas. They're pushing to disarm our soldiers on bases. They pushed back against him last year when he wanted to end the gun-free zone. And we need an equal and opposing force of civilian policy makers and thought leaders and conservative figures to push back. And honestly, in my entire career, I've never seen such a dearth of policy vision on our side.
Yeah. Well, this is one of the reasons why we value so much your appearances on our program, and I hope we'll have a lot more of them in 2020, Daniel Horowitz. But let me turn quickly to one last thing that you touched on that is worrying about these bills and more generally what's been happening. And I don't think there's been a more thoughtful, vocal, and impactful source of information about the criminal justice reform initiative, as it's known, than you, Daniel. And you have a piece that's out at Conservative Review recently about San Antonio and what's happening there as a microcosm of the larger problem. Give us a quick fill on that, if you would.
Sure. I think the American people are now starting to see crime going up, drugs going up, homelessness returning, the subway violence in New York, San Francisco, record homicides in St. Paul. We are reversing a 20 to 25 year trend. One of the best social trends that we've actualized, the reduction in violent crime. It's not quite back where it was in the 70s and 80s, but in some places it's getting there. And there's a reason for it. Soros and the Kochs have gotten together and they've convinced both parties in blue states, but also red states, to dismantle the criminal justice system piece by piece, every step of it, you know, reduce sentencing, more parole and probation, less aggressive policing.
Electing district attorneys.
Yeah, Soros district attorneys. One of the things that I wrote about in San Antonio that you're seeing is this trend of abolishing bail. So, you know, you pick up a sex offender, you pick up a guy on murder, they let the guy out on bail. Or they let the guy out without bail or very low bail.
Personal recognizance, I guess, is one of the options, right?
Exactly. And that's really been proven to be very weak. The ankle bracelets, you often have, you know, 50 officers monitoring 3,000 very volatile and violent criminals in a given police department. And what we're seeing is even with repeat offenders, they're letting them go. Because they're saying we don't have room in the jails, we don't want to hold people, and we're seeing the results.
Thank you for sharing these insights with us, Daniel. And as I say, hope to talk with you early and often in 2020. Thanks for what you've done for us and our country. Please come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.